the App and Urban Podcast, episode 62, the podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry.
And in this show, we talk to Russ Woodman from the Linux in the Ham Shack podcast, which is at lhspodcast.info, about his career in system administration, where he works for a broadband telecommunication carrier.
And I asked the question, what distribution should I use for a new server? Best practices and recommendations.
And we go over your lovely feedback.
And with that, let's get on with the show. This week we have special guest co-podcaster Russ Woodman, who is usually the one of the presenters on the Linux and the Ham Shack podcast. So, but Russ is also an admin in his day job. So, hello, Russ.
Well, good evening, gentlemen. Even though it's afternoon for me, how are you all?
We're doing very well. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you.
Very good. Yeah.
All right. Excellent.
So we're still trying to get our feet a little bit on recording this podcast, because obviously I'm new to the team. These guys are old hands by now, but
we've got a new setup, haven't we? Howard, we're doing a different way of recording it, so yeah, it's all good. So what's everyone up to then for the first couple of bit? I think you've got say something, John, about that you got something wrong on the last podcast.
Yeah, so last podcast, I waffled on for an inordinate amount of time about my Stryzen VPN server and explained all the wonderful, weird and wonderful things I was doing about routing and how it was coming in on one interface and going out the other one, and completely forgot that actually what I really do is one of the first things my little Stryzen box does as it comes up is changes the default route and ditches everything else. So everything I said in the last show was complete and utter rubbish. So I do sincerely apologize for anyone who was trying to follow along and couldn't figure out why it wasn't working for them and was working for me. So I do sincerely apologize.
There's loads of geeks out there just going,
No, there's probably two geeks going, why is he using Stryzen? Why isn't he just rolling it himself?
Well, now you know.
Now you know. So seeing as we have Russ on the show here with us, obviously Al and Jerry and I kind of, we have day jobs in, you know, different areas of technology. And one of the reasons that I asked Russ if he could join us, aside from the fact that he's a radio amateur like myself, because I know that he works in a different field of being an admin than any of the three of us. And I wanted to know a little bit about kind of what Russ's day job entails. So Russ, what does a day, you work for an ISP, as I understand it?
Well, I work for what started out as a telephone company that became an ISP that is now transmogrified into a broadband carrier, which is the parlance everyone likes to use now, because we kind of do a little bit of everything. It started out literally just as landline telephone. And when they started getting into internet services, that's when I came on board. I actually came on board shortly after Y2K because of, you know, Y2K. And they were in the midst of converting their internet service offerings from bulletin board systems using, you know, US robotics dial-up modems to something real. And so that's where I jumped in on that. And in the meantime, they started doing all kinds of other things besides just telephone and internet. And we've gotten into reselling satellite and doing cell phones and now triple play and everything else. So
what's triple play? Sorry.
Triple play is internet, phone, and television. That's
all right. Okay.
So I kind of thought that was a universal term. Apparently not.
Nope.
Okay. Well, that's what they call it here. That's what all the big MSPs and ISPs in this country call it, triple play, when they're providing the main three services, your telecommunications, your internet, and your video. So that's what I do. I have a little bit of a hand in all of that. I'm pretty much a back-end administrator. I do programming, systems administration, and database administration on a daily basis, and network administration, because I do all of the core network stuff. So I pretty much do it all. I'm in an IT team of five, and it's a small company, as you can tell. But my job encompasses all of that. So, and no one's really sure what my job actually is. They just know if there's something technology related that needs to be touched and manipulated in some way, that my number is the one they call.
So internally in your organization, you administrate, so you run the DSL provision and you also sell mobile telephony, I think you said, as well, and satellite services as well.
The satellite and the cellular are resold. We don't provide the services, we just resell those. But as far as the digital subscriber line, and yes, still dial up and the video, we actually have the head ends for all of that.
So without sort of wishing you to sort of divulge too many company secrets, what sorts of technologies are in play in those sorts of areas?
Well, I'm not sure what you're actually looking for in that. I mean, I can give out vendors and things like that. I'm not sure if that's relevant to the question you're asking, though.
So what I mean is more, is it lots of, in the, if you use the sort of the pets versus cattle kind of way of terminology, is it mostly pets or is it mostly cattle, or do you not know what I'm talking about?
I honestly don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, so is it mostly kind of servers that have been organically grown over years? So, you know, it started out as a database server and you installed a radio server on there as well, or, you know, is each machine like provisioned and, you know, could be destroyed and rebuilt from a script, or is there lots of sort of specific stuff in those boxes?
Okay, well, that's actually nice that you put it that way, because I can tell you that I don't know if the first thing you said was the pets version and the second part was the cattle version, but but if that's the case, then it's actually been a transition from one to the other. We started out with organically grown servers that basically I built from scratch that did certain things, and now I'm trying to move from that into virtualized environments and scripted setup procedures and things like that. So everything can be sort of built and destroyed dynamically and just spun up as necessary. So we're kind of in transition between one and the other right now.
So you're going from what would historically be called a pets environment going to a cattle environment. So interesting.
Yeah, it's taken a long time, but the biggest reason for the delay in that sort of transition in technology is the fact that I'm the only one doing it. So I can only do so much at a time. And I'm speaking within my company. Of course, I'm not the only person in the world doing this. So.
No. So you're the only IT, guy working for this ISP, basically, or is that a harsh way of looking at it?
That would be not entirely untrue, but there are other IT techs that work for my company, but none of them do the broad scope of things that I do, which is sometimes problematic, actually. It would be nice if somebody else could do some of these things so I wasn't, you know, beholden to doing everything. But, yeah, I mean, as far as the entire scope of like, all of the technologies that we use, I'm sort of the only one that touches everything.
So you like the escalation point for everyone, then?
Pretty much, yeah. I try and stay out of frontline tech support as much as humanly possible, but as soon as anything gets beyond the, you know, turn it off and on again, then yes, that's me.
So you are the point at which the sort of the shibboleth is engaged. It comes yes. Straight to you, yep. Then. To quote the old XKCD.
So yeah, I do it all, and like I said, sometimes that's nice. I mean, in a job security standpoint, it's a wonderful thing to have, but in every other respect, it's awful.
The bulk of your systems are, I think I remember you saying that you're very much an open source business. Is that right? Or have I misread that somewhere?
No, that's entirely true. We don't use 100% open source things, especially on the digital subscriber line side. And when it comes to internal computing, like for billing and financial solutions and stuff like that, tend to be proprietary, but everything on the internet side of things is open source. It is much as humanly possible.
So what sort of pieces of software are you using as an ISP? Is there any open source projects that are more important than others, or you use more?
We use everything that you would need to put an ISP together, and we do it with the open source version of whatever the thing is. So if you want to do DNS, we use, you know, ISC Bind. If we want to use Radius, it's free Radius. If we use a SQL server or an SQL server, it's MariaDB. And so, like, you know, wherever you have a technology where there's an open source version of the technology that can get the job done, that's what we try to use.
And do you do actual hosting? Do you host websites for people and so on, or are you just literally providing the pipes for people to use?
We do provide hosting, but we are a small enough service provider that the larger hosting providers can provide that service cheaper. So we don't have a lot of hosting companies, or customers rather, but we do have hosting customers, and we do have Apache and Nginx servers that provide that service. So it is something we do, but it's definitely not a focus.
Okay. If you were doing that, would you go to, say, a cloud provider or some sort of self off the shelf kind of solution, or you know, build a server for someone? Or
yeah, we would do it entirely in house. I am a big fan of keeping everything as far away from cloud services as humanly possible, to the point where we run our own cloud services when you need that particular kind of technology. We run the cloud stacks in-house.
So something like OpenStack, for instance.
We haven't gotten as far as doing that. That's something I would like to do. But again, all of these transitions into technologies that provide more robust services are something that I have to implement. And I basically am buried under about 40 projects right now. So I figure by about 2026, I'll have most of this done.
So have you always been into Linux? And that's how you've kind of got into this game?
Well, I started in VMS and BSD Unix before I got into Linux. But yes, I've always been into the Unices, even when they were proprietary. And I worked for companies that used Xenix and BSD Unix and the dreaded SCO Unix and so on. So I've been through it all. I've been all the way up through the ranks. And my first foray into Linux was actually contemporaneous with Minix. I was running Minix on a 286, and I was using Debian version 2, I think, or somewhere in there when I first made the switch over to Linux.
Turns out everyone's running Minix, aren't they? And their CPU firmware.
Yes, we've just found that out. We talked about that on our show a few weeks ago. Yep.
So talking about you mentioning your show there, so Linux in the Ham Shack is about using Linux and open source software as part of a radio amateur environment. Is there much in the way of, obviously not wishing to reduce your show down to sort of a couple of a couple of phrases, but you know, how much of the if you were an administrator of a sort of either a Unix or a BSD style system, how much of that knowledge could you make use of if you were to become a radio amateur and those sorts of things?
Well, from my perspective, I believe there's nothing you can't do as a radio amateur in the computer world that you can't do with open source. A lot of folks have come into being a radio amateur and doing computing as a radio amateur from before there was Linux. And so they became entrenched in the Microsoft way of thinking. And there are definitely applications that proliferate and have proliferated from that time. But the whole point of our podcast, and this, you know, was started almost 10 years ago now, was to break that cycle of dependence on Microsoft and realize that there are all these applications out there because there are people with like minds who have created these open source applications to allow radio amateurs to use their computers, and even not in a radio amateur way, but in an open source way. And that's the whole idea behind the show.
Turning the concept on its head slightly, how much of your radio amateur hobby and interest, how much of that gets to educate your your day job, your administration job?
I think it actually goes mostly the other way. I think I translate most of my day job and my hands-on learning of the applications and the systems that use Linux and open source from my day job, because I do that a lot more than I do things in the radio amateur world. So I think it goes from my day job perspective into my ham radio hobby, as opposed to the other way. I don't think I take much from the ham radio hobby and bring it back into my day job.
So you mentioned before that you started working in the ISP just after the year 2000 kerfuffle. How much has your job changed as a working for an ISP since that point?
Well, it's changed almost immeasurably, and I will specify that I got into this job after Y2K, but I've been a sysadmin since the late 80s. So I've been doing this a lot longer than the last 18 years of my current job. So I've pretty much, from the days of being in college, always been a sysadmin. And so I've been doing it a lot longer than I sort of let on there. But the the technology has just changed so much, and the ability, I think the thing that changed everything more than anything is the idea of virtualization and cloud stacking and doing everything AAS, everything is as a service now, and making I'm still in the middle of making that transition between the way things used to be and now providing everything as a service. It's almost like no one wants to examine hardware anymore. Everything needs to be compartmentalized and spun up as a little, a widget of code. No one wants to do anything as far as bare metal anymore. So it's quite a transition, and I'm still in the midst of making it.
I mean, everything is a REST API is another way of putting it.
And by the way, I hate SOAP. I just want to put that out there. SOAP is like the worst thing ever, but sometimes you have to use it. Sometimes the companies that we, the vendors provide their APIs, and they're done via SOAP, and it's just horrible. But luckily, most of the programming languages out there have prepackaged SOAP modules and REST API modules that kind of take some of the sting out of it. So I'm happy about that.
Well, the company I work for, hardware, is still a major part of our business. It's surprising. I mean, we're still monitoring stuff. We're still looking after things like OpenVMS systems and stuff for water utilities and stuff. So we still hold spares for those kind of equipment. So I don't think hardware's going away anywhere soon.
No, the hardware is not going away. What's going away is how close the hardware is to the end user.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I mean, in a lot of cases, the end user is more likely to be a developer in that sense, or it's going to be the end user that's sort of, even as far as provisioning the hardware, maybe, is coming from another service.
I do still like to personally keep the hardware as close to myself as possible and as close to the people that we provide service for as possible. I'm not a fan of cloud architecture. I'm not wanting to put all of our services out on AWS or anything like that. I do definitely like to keep things close, because the biggest part of that is transparency, at least from my own administration standpoint. I can see everything that's going on, and I know when we're having issues, and I know what to touch to fix those issues. Once you push that stuff out into the cloud, you're relying on someone else to do that. And I'm not on board with that. I'm not sure I ever will be.
And again, it's expensive as well, because I've been doing a quote this week, because I basically work from doing quotes to actually coming up with a solution, then putting the solution in. And people think the cloud is cheap, but it isn't. When you start ramping it up, it gets very expensive very quickly.
I mean, I think in a way, it's a way of moving the sort of hardware expertise somewhere remote. So farm it out to Amazon or Google or whoever and pay for the privilege, or have it in-house. Obviously, there's other concerns with cloud providers, sort of, privacy and data and that sort of thing.
For me, it's kind of a catch-22, because when you put those services out to someone else, you're reliant on them for their reliability and the break fix, which if I keep it close to me, then I'm the one responsible for that. But I would still rather be responsible for it than have to tell someone higher up than me that there's nothing I can do until Amazon fixes whatever their problem is.
Well, I mean, they say, like in their SLAs, they say in each region, you expect one. They say they generally have two or three data centers in each region. They say expect one of those to be down. So basically architect your a web app to route around it, or, you know, architect your infrastructure around it. I mean, there was a big thing when S3 went down, which is the storage service, which is almost unheard of. That happened last year. But yeah, it's basically expect and build redundancy into your actual app that you're running in the cloud. So it's kind of a different way of thinking about things. But
I agree. I'm better at answering questions than just speaking. So,
okay.
I can ramble on about everything, but I've heard most of the questions that I get asked about the podcast specifically, I've answered so many times, it's just boring to me. But if someone asks me, I'm more than happy to just ramble on. So,
okay. As someone that works for an ISP, have you heard of RENA, the Recursive Internetwork Architecture?
I can't say that I have, actually.
Okay. Again, I haven't done enough reading about it to actually talk about it knowledgeably, but I've been told to keep an eye on it by another sysadmin friend of mine. So it's basically a different protocol. It's not IPv4 or IPv6. It's more about a way of connecting networks together. There's quite a comprehensive Wikipedia page on it, which I'll stick in the show notes. But I have heard that it might be making its way into ISPs first, just because it removes the pain of IP, basically TCP/IP. You haven't heard of it, but keep an eye out for it, or keep an ear out for it.
Yep, I've already got the Wikipedia page bookmarked because I'm going to check it out as soon as we get done here. One of the things I like to do is learn something new every day, if at all possible. You know, we're at the point with our company that I have basically forced IPv6 into the network, and only a couple of people actually know that they're using it.
I was going to ask about IPv6, actually.
We've had a problem with even with the providers that we use to provide our connection to the main data network, with not even being able to provide us IPv6 connectivity. We're so still anti-IPv6 in the United States, it's ludicrous. But I made the jump in myself, and I've done all the administration and got the network up and working, so everyone's using it and they don't even know it.
So has the problem been mostly at the peering points, or is it further upstream even than that? Is it even just talking to the different ISPs that you connect to?
It's basically just at the hop one up from us. Our providers that we buy service from don't, until recently, provide IPv6 service. So I've had an IPv6 address space for several years now, because they're free and why not? And I haven't been able to implement it because no one could actually pass the IPv6 traffic to us. For a while, I was using Hurricane Electric as a tunnel broker to pass the traffic, but they limit bandwidth, so it was basically useless. Now we're actually getting to the point where some of our upstreams can provide native IPv6 access and BGP advertisements. So we're kind of coming up in that regard, but it's still a hard sell.
Changing the subject entirely, as I want to. One of the things that my close friends have started talking about is how the, I don't know whether you have the phrase over there about the cobbler's children have no shoes. What does your home network look like? Because we were talking about home labs last time. So what does your home network comprise of, roughly?
Literally the network in my house that I'm talking to you on now. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
Well, interestingly, I am not on the network of my ISP, because I don't live where my ISP is. So. So if, right. If you're trying to get some insight into how I'm actually providing myself service, that's not going to happen. So
it's probably a good thing, because when your employer goes, when the internet goes down, controlled by your employer, you can still get online and fix it.
It's actually not a good thing because my company, even though it's small, we only have, I want to say about 5,500 subscriber lines. We actually provide gigabit fiber service to our customers. And right now, my ISP, which is one of the largest ISPs in this country, and I'll decide at some point whether I want to badmouth them publicly, is only providing me a 10 meg down, 768K up circuit right now. And that's the best they say they can give me.
See, interestingly, I've seen a few posts over the last couple of months about, do you want to become your own wireless internet service provider? And I keep looking at it and thinking, that sounds like it's going to be so much fun. But then 5 months after it's in, it's going to be so much pain and heartache. I couldn't even possibly imagine going there.
Well, our wireless providers around here are horrible. Their bandwidth allocations are terrible. I live a little bit too rurally to partake of some of the decent services around here. I cannot get cable service. I'm reduced to one ISP or one WISP, and the WISP is useless, and so is the landline. They have dropped fiber within a third of a mile of my house, so I'm hoping that there's an upgrade on the horizon very soon. But my internet service currently is probably some of the worst in the country.
That's not good.
No, especially when you're trying to provide a podcast and, you know, stream audio, and we've even tried to stream video, but I have such limited upstream, it's just basically impossible.
So interesting to me, I've been listening to a couple of your episodes. So how does someone use Radiometer, use Linux? I mean, I didn't even know why you would. From an outsider who doesn't really do much with anything radio at all, what does Radiometer and Linux, what can you do? Why would you need it?
Well, if you become a radio amateur, you'll suddenly realize all of the things you can do with it. But if you're coming at it from the outside, it's kind of hard to explain. But in recent years, you know, people who are technology-minded have bridged computer hardware and amateur radio hardware to do digital mode communication, to do packet mode communication, to do GPS location services, and other things that are a little more basic that you do as a radio amateur, like log contact information and things like that. And all of that stuff has applications available for it for the radio amateur to use. The biggest thing that most people probably use a computer for in the ham radio space is for digital mode communication, which is basically you plug a sound card into a radio, or use a radio interface device, and then you have a software package that actually generates the keying modes, like the phase shift keying or whatever, that actually operates the radio and sends the digital mode communication, which is technically still analog because it's basically just tone generation over an analog carrier, but we call it digital. And then it gets decoded on the other end. And there are a myriad of applications which provide those services, and there are different modes. There are audio modes, video modes, and most recently we've just talked about a new mode where they're actually going to be able to do 720p streaming using ham radio, you know, broadcast airwaves. I've completely forgotten what that technology was, but so you know, and people use it for doing like BBSs, like the old style BBS that you used to use your modem for. Well, you can still do that, but do it on over ham radio. You know, I could go on and on and on, but if you want to find out about all of that stuff, it's just easier to listen to our show.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly, if there is anyone that's listening to the Admin Admin podcast that isn't already listening to Linux in the Ham Shack, it's not all about Linux. It's not all about amateur radio. There's a very good crossover between the two subjects, and on top of that, Russ's very good lady wife is also is one of the co-hosts as well, and she talks about cooking as well. So I would definitely recommend anyone that is interested in amateur radio as a hobby should listen to their podcast.
We try and keep it entertaining and not necessarily on topic, because staying on topic is good to a certain extent, but it can get boring over time.
It's also not very radio amateur-like.
Well, that's true. So yeah, I mean, there's so much you can do with it, but until you actually explore the hobby a little bit, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But also on the program, we talk about using your computer just as a computer and doing what normal people do, like browsing the web or streaming video or video editing or photo editing or things like that. We try and touch on a broad range of subjects because we know that amateur radio is probably a small part of your life, and we want you to be able to use open source for that as much as possible. But there are so many other interests and disciplines in the world. We do our best to kind of touch on everything.
Yeah, I mean, I've listened to the last couple. It's quite interesting. It's on my podcast list now. I mean, I've listened to the one about how to choose a distribution. So that was quite interesting. And another one about the BSD one. So yeah, it's interesting. I quite enjoyed it. It's the same as last time as us. We just start chatting and kind of end up off topic normally.
We usually start off topic and end off topic, and somewhere in the middle we hit the topic.
So talking about recent shows, I know that in one of the last ones I listened to, you guys were talking about using Ansible to run deployments and stuff. And that relatively nicely segues into another subject that's in our running order, which I've got a view on. Al, you were interested in setting up a Linux box.
Yeah, well, it's not... Yeah. If I have a bit of background, so I'm mainly a Windows sysadmin. Well, that's one of my traits kind of thing, but it's either Windows networking and hardware. So I come back from a Windows server background, but obviously I like getting into open source software and hosting a couple of websites. I run a Droplet, which is currently running a free BSD at the moment. I'll tell you how I got into that, how I'm running free BSD. So basically at work, I had to start looking after a couple of Linux boxes doing a number of things. And then I got suggested that I look at, they were running CentOS. So I basically set up a CentOS box to run a couple of WordPress sites on DigitalOcean. But as I started getting on a couple of running over a year, I found out every time that I was doing an update for WordPress, it was using more and more memory. And I think Jerry helped me out at the time that it kept just overloading. Is it like a kill command or something happened in Linux? So if it gets too far or too much memory, it kills one of the processes?
OOM killer, yeah. So it kills the one that it deems to have the highest or lowest score, one extreme or the other. The thing that's using the most memory, it'll just kill it if it's getting tight for memory.
So I was doing that. So, but at the same time, obviously you start listening to other podcasts. I would listen to, I think it's by Alan Jude about FreeBSD. So I decided to set up a FreeBSD box. I think it's version 10 at the time. And I was running that. Well, that's what's currently running my server at the moment, running a couple of WordPress sites. But, hey, okay, the documentation's is good and I enjoy using it. But the couple of things I found out is that, like, one at the moment, that there's no current patch or anything out for the Spectrum and I can't think what
the... You mean Spectre and Meltdown?
Yeah, Spectre and Meltdown. So that's one thing. And one thing as well is that it's you have to keep, when you do from like, the, I think it's currently 10.3 is their current release on the 10 branch. And to go from 10.1 to 10.2.10.3, you have to keep doing these jumps. And you run a script to upgrade it. And there's like a couple of things doing it you have to do to like edit a file and to make sure that it works, you get 10.3. But no one can explain to me like why you have to edit those files, edit these, take these lines out, and do it. So it seems to me that you have to know what you're doing in FreeBSD to kind of to know what you're doing, kind of thing. And unless you're doing it day in day out, which I'm not. So I want to basically migrate away from that and migrate back to a Linux. After that journey into Linux, and I think I've chosen that I want to go to do Ubuntu 16.04 as my kind of default install base. I mean, I've been looking at Ansible, which is really good. I think we're going to go quite deep dive in a couple of episodes' time. Is that how to deploy? I mean, I mentioned you got my Ansible script now to so I can create a droplet and then deploy, change the root password, and then deploy a couple of users, copy the keys across and set permissions, and then lock the root user out so it can't, you can't SSH in by root. But I'm just wondering what you, your guide recommending, what you would suggest for as a server REST. I mean, the reason I really think I've chosen that is I think if I have any problems, I've got you two to come along to help out. But as also things like, what are you recommending regarding coming about like SSHing in? I mean, I've disabled, always like disabling password authentication, but make sure you're logging in via keys. And then do you think, do you recommend that when you log in sudo that you should put a password in, or you don't have a password to write sudo kind of thing? So I was just wondering what your, what all three of you would suggest or recommend, or any pointers.
First of all, you can, with, because you're, the thing that you're using is basically WordPress, all you've got there is a bunch of static files and MySQL database. So theoretically, you can, as long as you've got backups of that, you can use any OS that you want underneath it. It's just a case of configuring the websites and so on, and sticking the data back in place. So you do have the option to jump around between either different distributions, or if you fancy going back to BSD, one of the BSDs, there's no, there's nothing to against doing that, as long as you know how to deploy WordPress onto a given OS, a substrate, as it were. So, but I mean, personally, I mean, I've been using Ubuntu recently and Debian. Mainly, the thing with Debian, the main strength of Debian is it has a lot more packages in its repos, whereas with CentOS and especially Red Hat, the whole getting software onto your box can be a bit more involved. That's basically my sort of very high level reason for choosing Ubuntu slash Debian.
So I must admit, I'm pretty much the same. My views is that. On top of everything else, there tends to be a lot more documentation, and particularly not so much novice friendly, but early administration on that kind of early part of the path documentation.
Simple how-tos, really, to get things running.
Yeah, there tends to be a lot more for Ubuntu and Debian-based systems than there does for Red Hat and CentOS-based systems. And from my view on things, especially if you are looking at deploying your service, your system using something like, you know, Ansible or something like that to actually provision your server, then actually I wouldn't have SSH anything other than certificate based, pre-shared key based. And if you need to SSH into it, it means that something's gone drastically wrong by that point. And you should really be treating it, again, using the pets and cattle analogy from earlier. You know, this is part of a herd. So if you're at the point where you need to be SSHing into that box, what you should actually be doing is standing up a new box, transitioning the services over to the new box, and killing the old one. That's the way I would try and look at things.
Yeah. I mean, it is useful to do that for a single server, but maybe not necessary in our case. However, it's a good way of learning all that stuff, which is kind of the way that system administration is going these days.
Yeah. And that's why we're doing it. I want to script it so that I can, if I need to, like, I can just rerun it. If I want to set it up at home, I can put it to my VMware box and then boot it up and use the same scripts.
Yeah. Well, when you've sort of gone through this exercise, you'll probably be an expert in deploying your WordPress sites to different service. So I think in your particular case, the best thing to do is hop around a bit. And although not that there's that many choices to hop around to, I say you're pretty limited for a sort of production website, you're probably limited to Ubuntu, Debian, and CentOS or Red Hat these days. But it's worth learning the differences between them and how to get software onto those machines in a sort of automated and repeatable way.
You probably wouldn't want to necessarily overlook SUSE either. It gets overlooked fairly often, and it is an RPM-based system, but it does have a good following and a good support base. And if you want to do things that are not necessarily CentOS or Scientific Linux, then you could certainly look at SUSE, because it has a good repository, back end, and it is something you could do that. And one nice thing about stuff like Ansible is it works on anything. You just have to script it appropriately. So you could even have one server running Ubuntu and the other one running CentOS or SUSE, and maintain them both, just so you keep a finger on the pulse of both types of systems. I actually run a NAS and another mail store specifically on CentOS, just so I don't forget CentOS.
I'd love to forget CentOS. A lot of the customers, the smaller clients I look after, have the hosting companies keep providing CentOS 6, which I looked, and to my horror, the end of life is, I think, 2020 for that. So I've got a good couple more years of having to put up with it, but it's really getting quite long in the tooth now.
Oh, I'm well aware of that. We still have a server in production right now. Luckily, it's behind a firewall and doesn't do anything, but it's running FC4.
Oh, right.
Wow. That is very dated.
Yes, it is.
I work for a server company, so sort of server building company in the mid-2000s, and they standardized on Fedora Core 2, which is, I was like, that's a bit of a moving target to standardize on, but oh well. They didn't last very long.
Yeah, even as late as 6 years ago, I think we were running Spark S390s.
Yeah, so the firm that I work for, I think, are the last commercial CPU vendor that actually producing Spark chips, to the extent that even Oracle have taken Solaris out the back and kissed it gently goodnight.
Well, that's a shame. They just should have shot it in the head.
But the other thing as well about when you're picking your server distribution, I know that the particular case for Al in this is that he wants to host a website, but the other thing as well to bear in mind is commercial support. So realistically, what Al could be doing, is, as I said, treat it as a part of a herd, and when something doesn't work right, stand another box up and shoot the one that you've got. But if you're looking to get commercial support, then actually you really do need to be looking at one of three distributions, which are Ubuntu, because Canonical are a commercial backer for that, and so you can purchase commercial support from them. Red Hat, or one of the products that they own. So Fedora or CentOS are both products that they own. Or SUSE, as was mentioned before. My experience with SUSE has not been particularly positive on the desktop side of things. And I must admit, I didn't properly look at it from a server side of things. But it is definitely a viable product.
It's quite interesting with SUSE as well, because both HPE, a lot of their software, so like there's a product they got called OneView, which is basically an OVA appliance you can install on VMware, and that basically means that you can give your service talk to, and then that talks back to HPE if you have a hard disk fail. That runs SUSE, and also VMware runs SUSE. So with the vCenter, which is the one that controls all the ASXi hosts, that runs SUSE as well. So it's definitely mainstream with those two companies.
I think I thought VMware used to be like a Red Hat based distro, but interesting that they've gone to SUSE now.
Yeah, they've gone to Seuss, both of them as well. Another product we use called D2D, which is a store once product, is used to be Red Hat, and that's gone to Seuss.
Seuss, where they've changed hands a few times over the last 10 years, I think it's made it difficult for... initially, it made it very difficult for people to consider them as their first choice, particularly when Red Hat was the name in sort of the commercial offering, and Canonical's Ubuntu was kind of making their name as the sort of the community open source side of things. Seuss was kind of stuck in this middle ground. Their acquisition by Novell made that quite a difficult position for them to be in, and I think when they got bought by, I think it's Micro Focus, a couple of years ago, they're just kind of coming out the other side of that now, and they're starting to be, you know, they're trying pretty hard to take that, to basically find their position again. So the fact that these products are all sort of starting to be based on Seuss is an interesting place for them to be going.
Going back to my original question as well, what you guys recommending? So obviously SSH key-based authentication, obviously not password, disabling root logon so you can't log on via SSH. What are your guys' opinions on sudo and then putting a password in to run the sudo command?
I've actually heard it argued that it's better not to have a password for if you're logging in as non-root. There's a chance if you have to type a root or even your own password to become root, there's a chance you could end up typing it on the command line and it would end up in your bash history, thereby being slightly less secure. So you've got the security of key-based authentication and no password authentication. That's probably good enough. And then you have to become root, but that's an extra step. So you can't, if your key did get compromised, you couldn't do something directly as root on the box, so basically remote controlling it via SSH or something. You still got that extra step of having to become root to do something.
Another option that you could look at if you're concerned about sudo is that what you could do is make it so that you use the Google Authenticator, the TOTP.
OAuth.
It's not OAuth, it's TOTP.
Okay, right.
So effectively, it's an offline one-time password.
Yeah, time-based one-time password. So
essentially, there are some quite easy to implement modules in the Debian repositories to implement the Google Authenticator into your PAM, the pluggable authentication modules. So I've got that set up for a couple of boxes I've got. And essentially it's just so you'd put in your password and it would then prompt you for the six digits. So if you do want to have something that requires a login, you can look at using the Google Authenticator instead of using just a single root password. And the fact that it's offline as well means that, you know, if you need to access a console because you've just taken down your network interface, you can still log into it. So I'll stick some notes on that into the show notes as well.
Yeah, that'd be interesting, yeah.
So the right way to set permissions on a web directory to running kind of WordPress, because it's always permissions for me coming from a Windows background is always really confusing about where you have the owner, the group, and then the other. If I explain what I think the way you should be doing, and then you can tell me if you think it's right or wrong, if that's okay?
Yeah.
So with my solution, what I want to get set up is that I want to have a WordPress site, but the people who there's a couple of ones, but different people have, I don't want to have different people can dial in and put their files in the FTP or FTPS. or using SSH to get the data in there. But I don't want them to have access to the other person's the files. So I was going to say that it's always puzzled me what is the best way to do this. And I was looking online this afternoon, and it's really confusing. If it's just working out the right terms, is that do you set that as having like a multi-user on one server that you that the way I was thinking you did it, so you have the owner who owns the file, so the people who are FTPing, let's say their files up, will be the owner, and then the people, then you set so they've got the rights so they can read and write those files, and then have a group which has got the what Nginx can see, so that they will only have read access, and then the use, and then everyone else has it hasn't got no access to it at all. Does that make sense, what I've just said?
Yeah.
Well, that's how it, I generally set it up. There's usually, when you set up a web server, there's a web server user, which can be like Apache or www-data or something like that. And you assign the group permission to all the files that are served by the web and give them read-only access, unless it's something that does have to be written from the HTML interface, but you only give write access to the group for those particular files, then read-write to the user a zero access to other. And then you can even go a step beyond that and use an htaccess file or something similar, some other similar mechanism for denying access to the web server itself to any files that shouldn't be exposed other than, you know, PHP scripts or static HTML that actually need to be served.
Okay, so that's quite cool. So like wwdata, I'd then set that as the group of that folder. That's quite cool. So the other thing as well, before I go, is that how does it, so if I set the permissions up on the root folder of those permissions, when you copy or people upload their files into that directory, do they automatically get given the permissions of the root folder?
They do if it's set UID, and that's something you could set either in the FTP server or on the file system itself. It's just how you want to configure that particular access to the files that are uploaded.
I should probably say that set UID and set GID are not generally set by default. So if you're kind of a bit new to it, that takes a bit of research and looking into. I remember it confused me greatly when I started looking at all this stuff.
And actually, the behavior of set UID and set GID can be very different depending on what they're set on.
It sounds like you might actually be approaching this almost from the wrong direction, Al. It sounds like what you might almost need to do is look at potentially moving to something like containers or a cheroot environment for each of the people that are hosting these sites, so that they literally have no network access, no access at all to anything that isn't specifically linked to their user, and then have the Nginx that sits almost at the bottom of that, providing almost a reverse proxy to those containers. It's not necessarily the most performant way of looking at things, but it's certainly a much more secure way of looking at things. Don't know how many users we're talking about.
Yeah, if you're trying to isolate users entirely from each other, then yeah, you would want to look at something like that, because assigning even readable group permissions allows people to just copy stuff.
So if I was a member of the WWW group, which I would almost need to have to be able to give that group access to my files, that means that everyone else that is in the WWW group will then have access to those files. And that would include things like passwords for your MySQL database or MariaDB. You know, it would contain the secret key for any REST APIs. And through that, you would then get access to the database server. By isolating that access out completely, to a separate subsystem, which is effectively what you would be doing with a Troot or something similar. You're protecting those files. Then it's more work to set up, and it's not something that I've done particularly with any sort of anger on anything other than just kind of my own test environment. But certainly that would be a better way of looking at things, particularly if you're hosting data for other people.
There is another layer there, which hasn't been mentioned, which is ACLs, which is kind of another permissions layer, which where you can get a bit more granular with permissions. But again, it's generally obfuscated and not a lot of people know about it. So just to throw that in there.
If you do limit the file system access in your FTP client, for example, or via SSH, then having the group permission is not generally an issue, because in the Chroot environment, users can't just switch out and get to other people's directories. But you would still want to HTTP access or otherwise limit access to files being served by HTTP, because anything that's servable is readable and therefore copyable. But a file that you wouldn't necessarily want to serve, like your wp-config file, for example, you can make it so that it's not readable via the server, the HTTP server.
Cool. That's really helped, guys. Thank you.
Moving on to our next topic. Obviously, I've mentioned that I work for a managed services provider. Jerry is freelance, typically doing software deployments. Russ works for an ISP.
Broadband carrier.
My apologies. I don't know whether...
No, that's okay.
Triple play broadband carrier.
So there's a question about what sort of environment is the best sort of environment to work for. It might be worth us kind of trying to explain a little bit about what some of these terms are, particularly as one of the notes in our little running order here does say, from one of the co-hosts, I'm not entirely sure what we're talking about here. So Al, do you want to explain, because I think you put the question in.
It's one of my things where I think things over in my head. Am I in the right job? Am I going the right way? I was at a Microsoft conference the other day, and there was lots of people there, but it was mainly focused on getting Azure into big companies, and a lot of the people there were just like working for universities, working for big other corps, and it's just one of those things where my mind saying, am I in the right place? Because I mean, I really enjoy working for an MSP, but do people enjoy working for one company at a time, or do you work for yourself? It's just, I wanted to kind of have a bit of discussion regarding this, really, because I quite enjoy where I work, because I get to see different technologies all the time. And if we get a new opportunity comes up and I have to learn something, that's what I really like. And you don't get too many company politics with, like, if you work in a big organization where you get the politics of HR and who's doing this and who's doing that, and they get all the issues you get around the water cooler kind of issues. But if you work for that kind of company, then obviously you only work on what the company can afford. If it's a single company, it's like in working, if you've got one, they've got a business, and normally the business is driven on making as much money. It's not worried about IT. It's just get what the kit in we can do. And what I've seen in the past is you're dealing with lots of old kit, or you're running with outdated software kind of thing. So I wondered what kind of people's what they prefer to do, really.
Well, I mean, from my point of view, I spent 9.5 years working for the same company, and since then I haven't worked for the same company for more than a year, in most cases 6 months or less. And I've got to say, I prefer the latter. Partly because it's a bit more lucrative, to be honest. But I mean, that from my point of view, it's great working for different companies, freelancing effectively, although it's still really a day job. It's still doing 9 to 5 in most cases. But I definitely prefer doing that, because I get to see more, get to work for different companies, meet different people, work on different stuff. So for me, it's a lot more interesting. Maybe a little less job security, but the way the market is for air quotes DevOps engineers at the moment is it's okay. Maybe I'll need to find something a bit longer term as I get older, but I'll think about that a little bit later down the line.
But again, though, saying that, if you're working for a single company, and one good thing is that you know if you have a problem or you set up a new site, you know how to do it because it's the same in, same out. But again, you get stuck into only using your hardware. So you might only know Windows 2003, 2008. And then when you, if that job, that company gets brought out from somewhere, you then on the job market and everyone else is running Windows 2012 in 2016, then you haven't, you've been in the same company.
One of the things I did when I was working for that 9.5 year gig was, make sure that I went and searched out software that other people were using. So in my case, it was configuration management stuff, starting off with Puppet. And so I suppose later going on to Ansible. But I made sure that I knew the stuff. And I actually, I did some work on the side, just freelance server maintenance and so on, which I'd be, you know, was talking about in the early episodes of this very podcast. And by doing that, I learned about the stuff that I'd missed out on over the years, which is basically all the web side of things I hadn't actually come into contact with because I was working in a company that wasn't using web-facing software. So I think my take on it is just go and learn the stuff, A, that interests you, and B, that you think you might be able to work with professionally in the future.
So from my side of things, I've been working with the same firm for 15 years now, same firm, but I've gone through five different jobs inside the same company in that time. And we're quite a large, we're more of a solutions integrator than a managed services provider. So we have, Al mentioned before about, you know, you don't have all the politics and the, you know, the water cooler sniping. If anything, it becomes worse the larger the firm gets, I've found. Because what you tend to get is, we're a global company, and between, say, the way that our one team works in the UK will be completely different from the way that our team in, say, Germany works. And we're going through these big reorganization programs to try and restructure that and make sure that we're all working the same way. And that's part of that comes down to direction set by management. But part of that comes from the fact that for a large proportion of the time that the company's been operating, we have been lots of tiny companies all under one big umbrella brand. Now, that said, you know, I love working for the firm because you said before about, you know, you get to work on, you know, whatever the company wants to get you to work on. That may be the case, but from one week to the next, because of the breadth of customers that we have, I might be working on three completely separate technologies between day one and day three. So it's very difficult because every firm is going to be completely different. And I think Jerry is exactly right. You know, you find something that you're interested in, you want to work on, and you make a thing about that. And if that ends up taking you down the path of, you know, leaving the firm you're working for and going to work somewhere else, then so be it. If that means doing a sideline job, you know, two evenings a week to cover the gaps that you're missing in your day job, then so be it. But that's just me. And I think I'm quite fortunate in the firm that I work for and the way that we work. So how about you, Russ?
Well, sorry, for me, I've been working at the same kind of firm pretty much since I've been working. So I don't have any outside perspective on what other kind of job I might be interested in, because I worked for a, you know, small to medium sized company, pretty much as the solo or close to solo administrator. And so that's all I'm really familiar with, which on the one hand is good because I actually like that environment and I don't mind the responsibility necessarily. And I do like the, I guess, minimal accolade that comes along with that. But it also limits my upward mobility for sure. So it's something I have to be comfortable with, which I guess I am because I've been doing it for over 25 years now. So, being able to speak to the way another type of company might work, like a larger one or a government or a educational institution or something like that, I can't really do that because I have no experience in it. But for the kind of job that I've done for all of these years, I like it, and I like the fit that I am with the company that I work for. So I don't know if that's really answering a question or even taking that in a direction where I've offered any information, but that's really all I can speak to.
I'm just curious, Russ, and I hope you'll forgive me for asking, but is there a Russ gets hit by a bus emergency pull this handle procedure?
There actually is, and those words are used in it.
Okay. It's always, yeah, I mean, I've been using it for years. What happens if Jerry gets hit by a bus?
Yep, there absolutely is. I mean, when you're an IT department essentially of one, there's no way around it. You have to have a fail-safe. I mean, it's just pragmatic. I don't, you know, I'm not offended by it. I mean, I understand it's a logical concern.
It's good to know that there is one anyway.
I think it mostly involves a lot of screaming and hand flailing, but
it's about what to do when when the wailing and gnashing of teeth subsides, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether that's answered your question now.
It wasn't a question. It was just kind of discussion, really. Because I have these philosophies where my head goes round and round. Am I in the right place? Am I doing the right thing? And it just sort of been a nice topic to have a chat about.
So the one other thing that I think helps me from having too many of those conversations with myself is actually that when I get time to spare to look at things that are not work related, I find a project to do, and I work on that project. Sort of the last sort of 3 or 4 months has been working on refining code and improving the performance and the way that another podcast that I'm involved in works. Before that, it was using Ansible with blog.org.uk. I've just started sort of working on a little project to see how something would work and fit together. And I think really the way to stop yourself from feeling like you're missing out on something in work is to have something outside of work that kind of covers off those fears.
And if it makes money outside work, so much the better. That's the way I look at it.
That's basically why I'm learning Ansible at the moment, because there's something I want to do. Because I think with the job I'm doing is that I see what happens with customers coming to what they want to do and then going to these Microsoft events and stuff. That's why I wanted to learn not programming, but scripting and kind of things. Because I know that in the future, that if I want to do something or something ever happens to my job, I've got a backup plan maybe to do.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, from my experience over the last 6 months, Ansible works pretty well on Windows as well,
yeah,
on Windows servers. And even desktops as well.
So we asked on the last episode, we had some feedback because obviously we've got a new format to the show, and we wanted to know what you liked about the show, what we're going to change about it, if there's anything you'd like improving or disapproving. So we basically, we had some feedback from our Telegram group and a couple of, an email come in. So do you want to go through those?
So, okay. Gary Williams messaged us on our Telegram group and said that he'd been listening to the podcast and he inherited a network a few years ago which had a bunch of servers called Server X, which had no consistency around the naming of redundant pairs. So you might have Server 10A and 10B were a pair, but then servers 26, 27, and 28 were a clustered group of three servers. He also mentioned that he's used SQL connection strings for liveservice.company.xyz pointing to live production and then internal points to the one for the CRM and things like that. He mentions that with new servers, they try and use DFS paths for file shares to avoid that issue and CNAMEs for servers, which means that they can easily repoint stuff that isn't dependent on horrible permissions mangling. And then he says he guesses it's just the pain of a large network with lots of legacy in-house apps running. And I can definitely agree with that.
Yeah, definitely Microsoft is the last 6 years, whatever they've done, has gone and done a lot better with using DNS names to point stuff to, and it's a lot better these days. But I think we've gone to that depth into another show. But it's basically just after what I was mentioning in the last show about how you name your servers.
There's another one from Mike Bickerton. He says it's good! ! So that's great. It's good to know that we're doing well. Thanks, Mike. Oh, he did say a bit more as well. I won't go through the whole email, but. Basically, he enjoys conversations that start off on a specific topic and end up being a story about one of the presenter's particular issues with that. So he likes his rambling. We seem quite Windows-centric, and that's interesting to him. He's 100% Linux. He's also tech support for his daughter's eye gaze controlled device, which has to run Windows, which sounds interesting. The new audio sounds great. That's good. New mics. Hopefully this episode will sound even better than the last one. He listens to lots of shows, and this is the one he enjoys the most. It comes out less frequently than others, and he spots it in his podcast queue, and he always moves it to the top. Oh, thanks, Mike. He asked about the theme music. Can we elaborate on that?
There's details on the website about that, I think, somewhere.
Yeah, it was Andy, the he used to help present it. So yeah, that was from his band, the Fox Gloves or something, and that's a link on the show notes and on the thing to his the website.
Yeah, there is an episode many episodes ago where we play the whole song, isn't there?
Yeah,
as well. And on a totally different matter, he says that he agreed to blog about his experience with Nominet registrars and using the free DNS host Hurricane Electric, which I think you mentioned, Russ.
I mentioned it earlier because I was using it as an IPv6 tunnel broker.
Okay, right, yeah.
So if you haven't already joined our Telegram group, but he'd basically ask, he had a school domain name which didn't provide any DNS facilities for. All you could do is set the market.
Name server records.
Yeah, the name server records.
Okay.
So it wasn't like he'd bought a .co.uk and like with 1-2-3 region you get free. It's because it was a .school.uk.
Okay.
And he asked a Telegram group what people could use, and someone recommended...
Paul Tansom.
Yes. Recommended that he should try that out. And he said that he's going to make a blog post on it. So he's going to put a blog post out on that. So we'll put a link in the show notes to that.
Yeah, there's a couple more of those. Just to mention, I use Zonomi, Zonomi. And there's also DNS Made Easy. The good thing about those is they offer an API, so you can programmatically sort out your DNS if you want to. But they also have a nice GUI where you can do it as well.
The reason he wanted something that was free, which he didn't have to pay for, okay. What he was trying to do.
I think I pay something like 50p a month for my DNS.
Do they give you a nice, easy way to do IPv6 PTR records?
I'd have to have a look at that. I don't think Zonomi do, no, but I'm only on IPv4 at the moment.
If you have to manage IPv6 reverse DNS, you know what a nightmare it is.
Right, okay. I haven't crossed that bridge yet, but I'm sure I will.
So, carrying on with the feedback, Paul Tansom, who we mentioned a few moments ago, said that he used to use naming conventions based on the Windows domain and function on NT4 servers when that was still current. He said he tends to avoid that now. He did say that he only works with small networks, though. He has two conventions for naming devices, citations and colors, colors being a subset of citations for external servers. Apparently, it switches between blue and gray each time he upgrades to a new VPS. We also had some feedback from, again, from Mike Bicko in the Telegram channel, where he also mentioned that all the machines at home have various nicknames for his daughter, whereas machines he administers for other people are usually named according to their function, and says that he's a bad person, clearly. Yeah, you're not a bad person, Mike. Just confused. No, I'm only kidding.
Wasn't there something someone wanted to ask us about backups, what people do for their backups, and if anyone had any recommendations?
I think that may actually have to be a subject for another podcast, because that could potentially go very, very, very deep.
We could do a whole episode on that, really.
Also, if we just ask the question and people can email in, that was all.
That is a really good idea. If you have got some suggestions about how you would do a backup for your clients and customers that doesn't involve spending money, which obviously makes it a little bit more tricky, what do you do? How to do something as cheaply as possible with regards to backup.
I mean, just because of my solution, I would say you can spend a bit of money, but try and make it, say, under a fiver or even less, under £2.50 a month in English money.
See, that's really weird for me, because I just on photo backups alone, I am spending £8 a month for one cloud provider.
Oh, okay.
But then again, I did get very close to losing about 8 years worth of photos, and I got in an awful lot of trouble with my wife over that one. So it's made me very paranoid about losing pictures.
Google Photos.
So I found it. What he says is our customers have Linux servers on their site. Most don't have tape. We have Informix DB. Is that right? Informix, I-N-F-O-R, Mix DBs, and customer data. Currently are syncing tar GSIP through the night, backing up to USB on some sites remotely as well. If any Linux users out there, what do you do for customer site who don't want to pay for proper solution and is solutions for proper software recommendations? I guess what we do works. We cover from failures, but it's not great. I'm improving things as I go, but just like to hear what others do.
It's a discussion for next time, but I would say you can do it really cheaply. And if you're paying for someone to sort it out for you, you can pay a couple of extra quid a month for the backups and for the peace of mind. That's my take on it anyway.
So we did get some questions about trying to maybe do a deep dive on Ansible. And again, that one's going to go into a later show. But if you have got any feedback about what we've done with this show, or anyone else that you'd like us to get on an interview, or if there's anything else that you want us to try and do with the show, please don't hesitate to drop an email. And the email address for that will be in the outro.
Cool. So I think the last thing, just a couple of notices. Is there for events coming up?
There is indeed. So FOSS Talk Live is on the 9th of June at King's Cross in London. And that, some more details about that is at fosstalk.com. So that's FOSSTALK.com. We've got OgCamp on the 18th and 19th of August in Sheffield. And so for some more details on that, see OgCamp, that's Oscar Golf Golf C-A-M-P, Charlie Alpha Mike Popper.org. There's also some information going into the show notes as I'm speaking about the Glasgow pod crawl. So if whoever it is that's typing in that wants to update me, that'd be brilliant.
Two other things I want to say before we go is one about that. I heard about something called NetData, which is from that home lab thing on Facebook, actually, which is a Linux monitoring tool, which is a web interface. So I'm going to have a look at that before the next show.
I'd look at that on my laptop and it looks awesome. So we'll do a bit of a thing on it next time, I guess.
Although I think Russ did mention that he might have used it before or knows about it.
No, I looked at it after it was mentioned in the Telegram chat and I saw the demo interface and just thought it was completely information overload. The biggest problem with monitoring solutions is you want what's important, not everything. and NetData gives you everything.
I think it has the possibility of forwarding stuff to something like Prometheus, though, which is then you can you take all the information and then only take the bits you want from it, basically. So, yeah. But anyway, we'll have a look at that, a better look at that, and get back to it on another a future episode.
So the details about the Glasgow Podcrawl have just populated themselves in front of my eyes. So that's on the 28th of July. I don't have the URL for that, but if you want to know more about that, you might be best off joining our Telegram group, and we can pass any questions on to the person that's told us about the Glasgow Podcrawl.
Another thing about Telegram group toilet is I'll put a link in the show notes for IT security alerts, which Dave recommended. It's really good. It alerts you when there's major problems. And like yesterday, that's why I forwarded it to the Telegram group the other day about the WordPress vulnerability. So It's quite interesting. And I'll probably read that more than reading something online.
Another thing that's just happened, and I'm fresh back from, is I went to FOSDEM, the big open source conference, and Config Management Camp in Belgium. Got back late last week, so I haven't got time to go into it now, but I will do a bit of coverage on that in probably the next episode, hopefully.
Well, with that, I think we might have finished this show. So I want to say thank you very much to Russ for coming and joining us on this show. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me over. It's been fun to talk to you all as well.
Thanks, Russ.
Thank you. So as normal, we've got the on the show, on the website, we've got links to our Telegram group and our social media feeds. So yeah, thanks again, Russ, for coming on board. And anything else before we go, guys?
Not from me
either, so thank you very much.
Bye for now.
See you next time.